Side 12. For a minute, she held him in her reflective gaze. She felt completely mistress of the situation. I've watched you very carefully during the week I've been here. I've come to the conclusion that you really are fond of Dorothy. I should never have thought you capable of it.
I told you I was fond of her. I wouldn't do anything to cause her a moment's uneasiness. She's the best wife a man ever had.
Have you never thought that you owed her any loyalty?
What the eye doesn't see, the heart doesn't grieve for, he smiled. She shrugged her shoulders.
You're despicable.
I'm human. I don't know why you should think me such a cad because I fell head over ears in love with you. I didn't particularly want to, you know.
It gave her a little twist of the heartstrings to hear him say that. I was fair game, she answered bitterly.
Naturally, I couldn't foresee that we were going to get into such a devil of a scrape.
And in any case, you had a pretty shrewd idea that if anyone suffered, it wouldn't be you.
I think that's a bit thick. After all, now it's all over. You must see I acted for the best for both of us. You lost your head, and you ought to be jolly glad that I kept mine. Do you think it would have been a success if I'd done what you wanted me to do? We were dashed uncomfortable in the frying pan, but we should have been a damned sight worse off in the fire. And you haven't come to any harm. Why can't we kiss and make friends?
She almost laughed. You hardly expect me to forget that you sent me to almost certain death without a shadow of compunction.
Oh, what nonsense! I told you there was no risk if you took reasonable precautions. Do you think I'd have let you go for a moment if I hadn't been perfectly convinced of that?
You were convinced because you wanted to be. You're one of those cowards who only think what it's profitable for them to think.
Well, the proof of the pudding is in the eating. You have come back. And if you don't mind my saying anything so objectionable, you've come back prettier than ever.
And Walter? He could not resist the facetious answer which came to his mind. Charlie smiled.
Nothing suits you so well as black.
She stared at him for a moment. Tears filled her eyes and she began to cry. Her beautiful face was distorted with grief. She did not seek to hide it, but lay on her back with her hands along her sides.
For God's sake, don't cry like that. I didn't mean to say anything unkind. It was only a joke. You know how sincerely I feel for you in your bereavement.
Oh, hold your stupid tongue.
I'd give anything to have Walter back again.
He died because of you and me. He took her hand, but she snatched it away from him.
Please go away, she sobbed. That's the only thing you can do for me now. I hate and despise you. Walter was worth 10 of you, and I was too big a fool to see it. Go away! Go away!
She saw he was going to speak again, and she sprang to her feet and went into her room. He followed her, and as he entered, with instinctive prudence, drew the shutter so that they were almost in darkness.
I can't leave you like this, he said, putting his arms round her. You know I didn't mean to hurt you.
Don't touch me. For God's sake, go. Go away. She tried to tear herself from him, but he would not let her. She was crying hysterically now.
Darling, don't you know that I've always loved you? He said in his deep, charming voice. I love you more than ever.
How can you tell such lies? Let me go, damn you, let me go.
Don't be unkind to me, Kitty. I know I've been a brute to you. But forgive me.
She was shaking and sobbing, struggling to get away from him. But the pressure of his arms was strangely comforting. She had so longed to feel them round her once more, just once, and all her body trembled. She felt dreadfully weak. It seemed as though her bones were melting, and the sorrow she felt for Walter shifted into pity for herself.
Oh, how could you be so unkind to me? She sobbed. Don't you know that I loved you with all my heart? No one has ever loved you as I loved you. Darling,
he began to kiss her.
No, no, she cried.
He sought her face, but she turned it away. He sought her lips. She did not know what he was saying, broken, passionate words of love, and his arms held her so firmly that she felt like a child that has been lost and now at last is safe at home. She moaned faintly. Her eyes were closed and her face was wet with tears. And then he found her lips, and the pressure of his upon them shot through her body like the flame of God. It was an ecstasy, and she was burnt to a cinder, and she glowed as though she were transfigured. In her dreams she had known this rapture. What was he doing with her now? She did not know. She was not a woman. Her personality was dissolved. She was nothing but desire. He lifted her off her feet. She was very light in his arms. He carried her, and she clung to him, desperate and adoring. Her head sank on the pillow, and his lips clung to hers. Chapter 76. She sat on the edge of the bed, hiding her face with her hands.
"Would you like a drop of water?"
She shook her head. He went over to the washing stand, filled the tooth glass, and brought it to her.
"Come along. Have a little drink and you'll feel better."
He put the glass to her lips and she sipped the water. Then, with horrified eyes, she stared at him. He was standing over her, looking down, and in his eyes was a twinkle of self-satisfaction.
"Well, do you think I'm such a dirty dog as you did?" he asked.
She looked down. "Yes, but I know that I'm not a bit better than you. Oh, I'm so ashamed."
"Well, I think you're very ungrateful."
"Will you go now?"
"To tell you the truth, I think it's about time. I'll just go and tidy up before Dorothy comes in."
He went out of the room with a jaunty step. Kitty sat for a while, still on the edge of the bed, hunched up like an imbecile. Her mind was vacant. A shudder passed through her. She staggered to her feet, and going to the dressing table, sank into a chair. She stared at herself in the glass. Her eyes were swollen with tears, her face was stained, and there was a red mark on one cheek where his had rested. She looked at herself with horror. It was the same face. She had expected in it she knew not what change of degradation. "Swine!" she flung at her reflection. "Swine!" Then, letting her face fall on her arms, she wept bitterly. Shame, shame! She did not know what had come over her. It was horrible. She hated him and she hated herself. It had been ecstasy. Oh, hateful. She could never look him in the face again. He was so justified. He had been right not to marry her, for she was worthless. She was no better than a harlot. Oh, worse, for those poor women gave themselves for bread. And in this house, too, into which Dorothy had taken her in her sorrow and cruel desolation. Her shoulders shook with her sobs. Everything was gone now. She had thought herself changed. She had thought herself strong. She thought she had returned to Hong Kong a woman who possessed herself. New ideas flitted about her heart like little yellow butterflies in the sunshine, and she had hoped to be so much better in the future. Freedom, like a spirit of light, had beckoned her on, and the world was like a spacious plain through which she could walk, light of foot and with head erect. She had thought herself free from lust and vile passions, free to live the clean and healthy life of the spirit. She had likened herself to the white egrets that fly with leisurely flight across the rice fields at dusk, and they are like the soaring thoughts of a mind at rest with itself. And she was a slave. Weak, weak. It was hopeless. It was no good to try. She was a slut. She would not go in to dinner. She sent the boy to tell Dorothy that she had a headache and preferred to remain in her room. Dorothy came in and, seeing her red, swollen eyes, talked for a little in her gentle, commiserating way of trivial things. Kitty knew that Dorothy thought she had been crying on account of Walter, and sympathizing, like the good and loving wife she was, respected the natural sorrow. "I know it's very hard, dear," she said as she left Kitty, "but you must try to have courage. I'm sure your dear husband wouldn't wish you to grieve for him." Chapter 77. But next morning, Kitty rose early, and leaving a note for Dorothy to say that she was gone out on business, took a tram down the hill. She made her way through the crowded streets with their motor cars, rickshaws and chairs, and the motley throng of Europeans and Chinese, to the offices of the P&O Company. A ship was sailing in 2 days, the first ship out of the port, and she had made up her mind that at all costs she must go on it. When the clerk told her that every berth was booked, she asked to see the chief agent. She sent in her name, and the agent, whom she had met before, came out to fetch her into his office. He knew her circumstances, and when she told him what she wished, he sent for the passenger list. He looked at it with perplexity. "I beseech you to do what you can for me," she urged him. "I don't think there's anyone in the colony who wouldn't do anything in the world for you, Mrs. Fane," he answered. He sent for a clerk and made inquiries. Then he nodded. "I'm going to shift one or two people. I know you want to get home, and I think we ought to do our best for you. I can give you a little cabin to yourself. I expect you'd prefer that." She thanked him. She left him with an elated heart. Flight. That was her only thought. Flight. She sent a cable to her father to announce her immediate return. She had already cabled to him to say that Walter was dead, and then went back to the Townsends to tell Dorothy what she had done. "We shall be dreadfully sorry to lose you," the kind creature said, "but of course I understand that you want to be with your mother and father." Since her return to Hong Kong, Kitty had hesitated from day to day to go to her house. She dreaded entering it again, and meeting face to face the recollections with which it was peopled. But now she had no alternative. Townsend had arranged for the sale of the furniture, and he had found someone eager to take on the lease. But there were all her clothes, and Walter's, for they had taken next to nothing to Maitan Fu, and there were books, photographs, and various odds and ends. Kitty, indifferent to everything, and anxious to cut herself off completely from the past, realized that it would outrage the susceptibilities of the colony if she allowed these things to go with the rest to an auction room. They must be packed and sent to her. So after tiffin, she prepared to go to the house. Dorothy, eager to give her help, offered to accompany her, but Kitty begged to be allowed to go alone. She agreed that two of Dorothy's boys should come and assist in the packing. The house had been left in charge of the head boy, and he opened the door for Kitty. It was curious to go into her own house as though she were a stranger. It was neat and clean. Everything was in its place, ready for her use. But although the day was warm and sunny, there was about the silent rooms a chill and desolate air. The furniture was stiffly arranged, exactly where it should be, and the vases, which should have held flowers, were in their places. The book which Kitty had laid face downwards, she did not remember when, still lay face downwards. It was as though the house had been left empty but a minute before, and yet that minute was fraught with eternity, so that you could not imagine that ever again that house would echo with talk and resound with laughter. On the piano, the open music of a foxtrot seemed to wait to be played, but you had a feeling that if you struck the keys, no sound would come. Walter's room was as tidy as when he was there. On the chest of drawers were two large photographs of Kitty, one in her presentation dress and one in her wedding gown. But the boys fetched up the trunks from the box room, and she stood over them watching them pack. They packed neatly and quickly. Kitty reflected that in the 2 days she had, it would be easy to get everything done. She must not let herself think. She had no time for that. Suddenly she heard a step behind her, and turning round, saw Charles Townsend. She felt a sudden chill at her heart. "What do you want?" she said. "Will you come into your sitting room? I have something to say to you." "I'm very busy." "I shall only keep you 5 minutes." She said no more, but with a word to the boys to go on with what they were doing, preceded Charles into the next room. She did not sit down, in order to show him that she expected him not to detain her. She knew that she was very pale, and her heart was beating fast, but she faced him coolly, with hostile eyes. "What is it you want?"
"I've just heard from Dorothy that you're going the day after tomorrow. She told me that you'd come here to do your packing, and she asked me to ring up and find out if there was anything I could do for you. I'm grateful to you, but I can manage quite well by myself. So I imagined. I didn't come here to ask you that. I came to ask if your sudden departure is due to what happened yesterday. You and Dorothy have been very good to me. I didn't wish you to think I was taking advantage of your good nature. That's not a very straight answer. What does it matter to you? It matters a great deal. I shouldn't like to think that anything I'd done had driven you away. She was standing at the table. She looked down. Her eyes fell on the sketch. It was months old now. It was that paper which Walter had stared at all through the terrible evening when... And Walter now was... She raised her eyes. I feel absolutely degraded. You can't possibly despise me as much as I despise myself.
But I don't despise you. I meant every word that I said yesterday. What's the good of running away like this? I don't know why we can't be good friends. I hate the idea of your thinking I've treated you badly.
Why couldn't you leave me alone?
Hang it all. I'm not a stick or a stone. It's so unreasonable the way you look at it. It's so morbid. I thought after yesterday you'd feel a little more kindly to me. After all, we're only human.
I don't feel human. I feel like an animal. A pig or a rabbit or a dog. Oh, I don't blame you. I was just as bad. I yielded to you because I wanted you. But it wasn't the real me. I'm not that hateful, beastly, lustful woman. I disown her. It wasn't me that lay on that bed panting for you when my husband was hardly cold in his grave and your wife had been so kind to me, so indescribably kind. It was only the animal in me, dark and fearful like an evil spirit. And I disown and hate and despise it. And ever since when I've thought of it, my gorge rises and I feel that I must vomit. He frowned a little and gave a short, uneasy snigger.
Well, I'm fairly broad-minded, but sometimes you say things that positively shock me.
I should be sorry to do that. You'd better go now. You're a very unimportant little man, and I'm silly to talk to you seriously. He did not answer for a while, and she saw by the shadow in his blue eyes that he was angry with her. He would heave a sigh of relief when, tactful and courteous as ever, he had finally seen her off. It amused her to think of the politeness with which, while they shook hands and he wished her a pleasant journey, she would thank him for his hospitality. But she saw his expression change.
"Dorothy tells me you're going to have a baby," he said.
She felt herself colour, but she allowed no gesture to escape her. "I am."
"Am I by any chance the father?"
"No, no. It's Walter's child." She spoke with an emphasis which she could not prevent, but even as she spoke, she knew that it was not the tone with which to carry conviction.
"Are you sure?" He was now roguishly smiling. "After all, you were married to Walter a couple of years and nothing happened. The date seemed to fit all right. I think it's much more likely to be mine than Walter's."
"I would rather kill myself than have a child of yours."
"Oh, come now, that's nonsense. I should be awfully pleased and proud. I'd like it to be a girl, you know. I've only had boys with Dorothy. You won't be able to be in doubt very long, you know. My three kiddies are absolutely the living image of me."
He had retained his good humour, and she knew why. If the child was his, though she might never see him again, she could never entirely escape him. His power over her would reach out, and he would still, obscurely but definitely, influence every day of her life. "You really are the most vain and fatuous ass that it's ever been my bad luck to run across," she said. Chapter 78. As the ship steamed into Marseille, Kitty, looking at the rugged and beautiful outline of the coast glowing in the sunlight, on a sudden caught sight of the golden statue of the Blessed Virgin, which stands upon the church of Saint Marie de la Grâce as a symbol of safety to the mariner at sea. She remembered how the sisters of the convent at Maitain Fou, leaving their own land for ever, had knelt as the figure faded in the distance, so that it was no more than a little golden flame in the blue sky,
and sought in prayer to allay the pang of separation. She clasped her hands in supplication to what power she knew not. During the long, quiet journey, she had thought incessantly of the horrible thing that had happened to her. She could not understand herself. It was so unexpected. What was it that had seized her so that, despising him with all her heart, she had yielded passionately to Charlie's foul embrace? Rage filled her, and disgust of herself obsessed her. She felt that she could never forget her humiliation. She wept. But as the distance from Hong Kong increased, she found that she was insensibly losing the vividness of her resentment. What had happened seemed to have happened in another world. She was like a person who has been stricken with sudden madness, and recovering, is distressed and ashamed at the grotesque things he vaguely remembers to have done when he was not himself. But because he knows he was not himself, he feels that in his own eyes, at least, he can claim indulgence. Kitty thought that perhaps a generous heart might pity rather than condemn her. But she sighed as she thought how woefully her self-confidence had been shattered. The way had seemed to stretch before her straight and easy, and now she saw that it was a tortuous way, and that pitfalls awaited her. The vast spaces and the tragic and beautiful sunsets of the Indian Ocean rested her. She seemed born then to some country where she might, in freedom, possess her soul. If she could only regain her self-respect at the cost of a bitter conflict, well, she must find the courage to affront it. The future was lonely and difficult. At Port Said, she had received a letter from her mother in answer to her cable. It was a long letter, written in the large and fanciful writing which was taught to young ladies in her mother's youth. Its ornateness was so neat that it gave you an impression of insincerity. Mrs. Garstin expressed her regret at Walter's death and sympathised properly with her daughter's grief. She feared that Kitty was left inadequately provided for, but naturally the Colonial Office would give her a pension. She was glad to know that Kitty was coming back to England, and of course she must come and stay with her father and mother till her child was born. Then followed certain instructions that Kitty must be sure to follow, and various details of her sister Doris's confinement. The little boy weighed so-and-so much, and his paternal grandfather said he had never seen a finer child. Doris was expecting again, and they hoped for another boy in order to make the succession to the baronetcy quite sure. Kitty saw that the point of the letter lay in the definite date set for the invitation. Mrs. Garstin had no intention of being saddled with a widowed daughter in modest circumstances. It was singular, when she reflected how her mother had idolized her, that now, disappointed in her, she found her merely a nuisance. How strange was the relation between parents and children. When they were small, the parents doted on them, passed through agonies of apprehension at each childish ailment, and the children clung to their parents with love and adoration. A few years passed, the children grew up, and persons not of their kin were more important to their happiness than father or mother. Indifference displaced the blind and instinctive love of the past. Their meetings were a source of boredom and irritation. Distracted once at the thought of a month's separation, they were able now to look forward with equanimity to being parted for years. Her mother need not worry. As soon as she could, she would make herself a home of her own. But she must have a little time. At present, everything was vague, and she could not form any picture of the future. Perhaps she would die in childbirth. That would be a solution of many difficulties. But when they docked, two letters were handed to her. She was surprised to recognize her father's writing. She did not remember that he had ever written to her. He was not effusive and began, "Dear Kitty." He told her that he was writing instead of her mother, who had not been well and was obliged to go into a nursing home to have an operation. Kitty was not to be frightened and was to keep to her intention of going round by sea. It was much more expensive to come across by land, and with her mother away, it would be inconvenient for Kitty to stay at the house in Harrington Gardens. The other was from Doris, and it started, "Kitty, darling," not because Doris had any particular affection for her, but because it was her way thus to address everyone she knew. "Kitty, darling, I expect Father has written to you. Mother has got to have an operation. It appears that she has been rotten for the last year, but you know she hates doctors, and she's been taking all sorts of patent medicines. I don't quite know what's the matter with her, as she insists on making a secret of the whole thing, and flies into a passion if you ask her questions. She has been looking simply awful, and if I were you, I think I'd get off at Marseille and come back as quick as you can. But don't let on that I told you to come, as she pretends there's nothing much the matter with her, and she doesn't want you to get here till she's back at home. She's made the doctors promise that she shall be moved in a week. Best love, Doris. I'm awfully sorry about Walter. You must have had a hell of a time, poor darling. I'm simply dying to see you. It's rather funny our both having babies together. We shall be able to hold one another's hands." Kitty, lost in reflection, stood for a little while on the deck. She could not imagine her mother ill. She never remembered to have seen her other than active and resolute. She had always been impatient of other people's ailments. Then a steward came up to her with a telegram. "Deeply regret to inform you that your mother died this morning. Father." Chapter 79. Kitty rang the bell at the house in Harrington Gardens. She was told that her father was in his study, and going to the door, she opened it softly. He was sitting by the fire reading the last edition of the evening paper. He looked up as she entered, put down the paper, and sprang nervously to his feet.
"Oh, Kitty, I didn't expect you till the later train."
"I thought you wouldn't want the bother of coming to meet me, so I didn't wire the time I expected to arrive." He gave her his cheek to kiss, in the manner she so well remembered.
"I was just having a look at the paper," he said. "I haven't read the paper for the last 2 days."
She saw that he thought it needed some explanation if he occupied himself with the ordinary affairs of life. "Of course," she said, "you must be tired out. I'm afraid Mother's death has been a great shock to you." He was older and thinner than when she had last seen him. A little, lined, dried-up man with a precise manner.
"The surgeon said there had never been any hope. She hadn't been herself for more than a year, but she refused to see a doctor. The surgeon told me she must have been in constant pain. He said it was a miracle that she had been able to endure it."
"Did she never complain?"
"She said she wasn't very well. But she never complained of pain."
He paused and looked at Kitty.
"Are you very tired after your journey?"
"Not very."
"Would you like to go up and see her?"
"Is she here?"
"Yes, she was brought here from the nursing home."
"Yes, I'll go now."
"Would you like me to come with you?"
There was something in her father's tone that made her look at him quickly. His face was slightly turned from her. He did not want her to catch his eye. Kitty had acquired of late a singular proficiency at reading the thoughts of others. After all, day after day she had applied all her sensibilities to divine from a casual word or an unguarded gesture the hidden thoughts of her husband. She guessed at once what her father was trying to hide from her. It was relief he felt, an infinite relief, and he was frightened of himself. For hard on 30 years he had been a good and faithful husband. He had never uttered a single word in dispraise of his wife, and now he should grieve for her. He had always done the things that were expected of him. It would have been shocking to him by the flicker of an eyelid or by the smallest hint to betray that he did not feel what, under the circumstances, a bereaved husband should feel. "No, I would rather go by myself," said Kitty. She went upstairs and into the large, cold and pretentious bedroom in which her mother for so many years had slept. She remembered so well those massive pieces of mahogany and the engravings after Marcus Stone which adorned the walls. The things on the dressing table were arranged with the stiff precision which Mrs. Garstin had all her life insisted upon. The flowers looked out of place. Mrs. Garstin would have thought it silly, affected and unhealthy to have flowers in her bedroom. Their perfume did not cover that acrid, musty smell, as of freshly washed linen, which Kitty remembered as characteristic of her mother's room. Mrs. Garstin lay on the bed, her hands folded across her breasts, with a meekness which in life she would have had no patience with. With her strong, sharp features, the cheeks hollow with suffering and the temples sunken, she looked handsome and even imposing. Death had robbed her face of its meanness and left only an impression of character. She might have been a Roman empress. It was strange to Kitty that of the dead persons she had seen, this was the only one who, in death, seemed to preserve a look as though that clay had once been a habitation of the spirit. Grief she could not feel, for there had been too much bitterness between her mother and herself to leave in her heart any deep feeling of affection. And looking back on the girl she had been, she knew that it was her mother who had made her what she was. But when she looked at that hard, domineering and ambitious woman, who lay there so still and silent, with all her petty aims frustrated by death, she was aware of a vague pathos. She had schemed and intrigued all her life, and never had she desired anything but what was base and unworthy. Kitty wondered whether, perhaps, in some other sphere, she looked upon her earthly course with consternation. Doris came in.
"I thought you'd come by this train. I felt I must look in for a moment. Isn't it dreadful? Poor darling mother!"
Bursting into tears, she flung herself into Kitty's arms. Kitty kissed her. She knew how her mother had neglected Doris in favour of her, and how harsh she had been with her because she was plain and dull. She wondered whether Doris really felt the extravagant grief she showed. But Doris had always been emotional. She wished she could cry. Doris would think her dreadfully hard. Kitty felt that she had been through too much to feign a distress that she did not feel. "Would you like to come and see Father?" she asked her, when the strength of the outburst had somewhat subsided. Doris wiped her eyes. Kitty noticed that her sister's pregnancy had blunted her features, and in her black dress she looked gross and blousy.
"No, I don't think I will. I shall only cry again. Poor old thing. He's bearing it wonderfully."
Kitty showed her sister out of the house and then went back to her father. He was standing in front of the fire, and the newspaper was neatly folded. He wanted her to see that he had not been reading it again.
"I haven't dressed for dinner," he said. "I didn't think it was necessary."
Chapter 80. They dined. Mr. Garstin gave Kitty the details of his wife's illness and death, and he told her of the kindness of the friends who had written. There were piles of sympathetic letters on his table, and he sighed when he considered the burden of answering them, and of the arrangements he had made for the funeral. They then went back into his study. This was the only room in the house which had a fire. He mechanically took from the chimney-piece his pipe and began to fill it, but he gave his daughter a doubtful look and put it down.
"Aren't you going to smoke?" she asked.
"Your mother didn't very much like the smell of a pipe after dinner, and since the war I've given up cigars."
His answer gave Kitty a little pang. It seemed dreadful that a man of 60 should hesitate to smoke what he wanted in his own study.
"I like the smell of a pipe," she smiled.
A faint look of relief crossed his face, and taking his pipe once more, he lit it. They sat opposite one another on each side of the fire. He felt that he must talk to Kitty of her own troubles.
"You received the letter your mother wrote to you to Port Said, I suppose. The news of poor Walter's death was a great shock to both of us. I thought him a very nice fellow."
Kitty did not know what to say.
"Your mother told me that you were going to have a baby."
"Yes."
"When do you expect it?"
"In about 4 months."
"It will be a great consolation to you. You must go and see Doris's boy. He's a fine little fellow."
They were talking more distantly than if they were strangers who had just met. For if they had been, he would have been interested in her just because of that, and curious. But their common past was a wall of indifference between them. Kitty knew too well that she had done nothing to beget her father's affection. He had never counted in the house, and had been taken for granted. The breadwinner who was a little despised because he could provide no more luxuriously for his family. But she had taken for granted that he loved her, just because he was her father. And it was a shock to discover that his heart was empty of feeling for her. She had known that they were all bored by him, but it had never occurred to her that he was equally bored by them. He was, as ever, kind and subdued, but the sad perspicacity, which she had learned in suffering, suggested to her that, though he had probably never acknowledged it to himself, and never would, in his heart he disliked her. His pipe was not drawing, and he rose to find something to poke it with. Perhaps it was an excuse to hide his nervousness. "Your mother wished you to stay here till your baby was born, and she was going to have your old room got ready for you." "I know. I promise you I won't be a bother."
"Oh, it's not that. Under the circumstances, it was evident that the only place for you to come to was your father's house. But the fact is that I've just been offered the post of Chief Justice of the Bahamas, and I've accepted it."
"Oh, Father, I'm so glad. I congratulate you with all my heart."
"The offer arrived too late for me to tell your poor mother. It would have given her a great satisfaction."
The bitter irony of fate. After all her efforts, intrigues, and humiliations, Mrs. Garstin had died without knowing that her ambition, however modified by past disappointments, was at last achieved.
"I am sailing early next month. Of course, this house will be put in the agent's hands, and my intention was to sell the furniture. I'm sorry that I shan't be able to have you to stay here, but if you'd like any of the furniture to furnish a flat, I shall be extremely pleased to give it you."
Kitty looked into the fire. Her heart beat quickly. It was curious that on a sudden she should be so nervous, but at last she forced herself to speak. In her voice was a little tremor. "Couldn't I come with you, Father?"
"You? Oh, my dear Kitty."
His face fell. She had often heard the expression, but thought it only a phrase, and now, for the first time in her life, she saw the movement that it described. It was so marked that it startled her.
"But all your friends are here, and Doris is here. I should have thought you'd be much happier if you took a flat in London. I don't exactly know what your circumstances are, but I shall be very glad to pay the rent of it."
"I have enough money to live on."
"I'm going to a strange place. I know nothing of the conditions."
"I'm used to strange places. London means nothing to me anymore. I couldn't breathe here." He closed his eyes for a moment, and she thought he was going to cry. His face bore an expression of utter misery. It wrung her heart. She had been right. The death of his wife had filled him with relief, and now this chance to break entirely with the past had offered him freedom. He had seen a new life spread before him, and at last, after all these years, rest and the mirage of happiness. She saw dimly all the suffering that had preyed on his heart for 30 years. At last he opened his eyes. He could not prevent the sigh that escaped him.
"Of course, if you wish to come, I shall be very pleased."
It was pitiful. The struggle had been short, and he had surrendered to his sense of duty. With those few words, he abandoned all his hopes. She rose from her chair, and going over to him, knelt down and seized his hands. "No, Father, I won't come unless you want me. You've sacrificed yourself enough. If you want to go alone, go. Don't think of me for a minute." He released one of her hands and stroked her pretty hair.
"Of course I want you, my dear. After all, I'm your father, and you're a widow and alone. If you want to be with me, it would be very unkind of me not to want you."
"But that's just it. I make no claims on you because I'm your daughter. You owe me nothing."
"Oh, my dear child."
"Nothing," she repeated vehemently. "My heart sinks when I think how we've battened on you all our lives and given you nothing in return. Not even a little affection. I'm afraid you've not had a very happy life. Won't you let me try to make up a little for all I've failed to do in the past?" He frowned a little. Her emotion embarrassed him.
"I don't know what you mean. I've never had any complaint to make of you."
"Oh, Father,
I've been through so much. I've been so unhappy. I'm not the Kitty I was when I went away. I'm terribly weak, but I don't think I'm the filthy cad I was then. Won't you give me a chance? I have nobody but you in the world now. Won't you let me try to make you love me? Oh, Father, I'm so lonely and so miserable. I want your love so badly.
She buried her face in his lap and cried as though her heart were breaking.
Oh, my Kitty, my little Kitty, he murmured.
She looked up and put her arms round his neck.
Oh, Father, be kind to me. Let us be kind to one another.
He kissed her on the lips as a lover might, and his cheeks were wet with tears.
Of course you shall come with me.
Do you want me to? Do you really want me to?
Yes.
I'm so grateful to you.
Oh, my dear, don't say things like that to me. It makes me feel quite awkward.
He took out his handkerchief and dried her eyes. He smiled in a way that she had never seen him smile before. Once more she threw her arms round his neck.
We'll have such a lark, Father dear. You don't know what fun we're going to have together.
You haven't forgotten that you're going to have a baby.
I'm glad she'll be born out there within sound of the sea and under a wide blue sky.
Have you already made up your mind about the sex? He murmured with his thin, dry smile.
I want a girl, because I want to bring her up so that she shan't make the mistakes I've made. When I look back upon the girl I was, I hate myself. But I never had a chance. I'm going to bring up my daughter so that she's free and can stand on her own feet. I'm not going to bring a child into the world and love her and bring her up just so that some man may want to sleep with her so much that he's willing to provide her with board and lodging for the rest of her life.
She felt her father stiffen. He had never spoken of such things, and it shocked him to hear these words in his daughter's mouth.
Let me be frank just this once, Father. I've been foolish and wicked and hateful. I've been terribly punished. I'm determined to save my daughter from all that. I want her to be fearless and frank. I want her to be a person independent of others, because she is possessed of herself. And I want her to take life like a free man and make a better job of it than I have.
Why, my love, you talk as though you were 50. You've got all your life before you. You mustn't be downhearted.
Kitty shook her head and slowly smiled. I'm not. I have hope and courage. The past was finished. Let the dead bury their dead. Was that dreadfully callous? She hoped with all her heart that she had learned compassion and charity. She could not know what the future had in store for her, but she felt in herself the strength to accept whatever was to come with a light and buoyant spirit. Then, on a sudden, for no reason that she knew of, from the depths of her unconscious, arose a reminiscence of the journey they had taken, she and poor Walter, to the plague-ridden city where he had met his death. One morning, they set out in their chairs while it was still dark, and as the day broke, she divined rather than saw a scene of such breathtaking loveliness that for a brief period the anguish of her heart was assuaged. It reduced to insignificance all human tribulation. The sun rose, dispelling the mist, and she saw winding onwards as far as the eye could reach, among the rice fields, across a little river, and through undulating country, the path they were to follow. Perhaps her faults and follies, the unhappiness she had suffered, were not entirely vain if she could follow the path that now she dimly discerned before her, not the path that kind, funny old Waddington had spoken of, that led nowhither, but the path those dear nuns at the convent followed so humbly, the path that led to peace.
That was The Painted Veil by Somerset Maugham, read by Sophie Ward. We do hope you've enjoyed listening to this Chivers audiobook. For details of other Chivers recordings, please contact us and we'll be delighted to send you a catalogue listing all our titles and recent releases. Our telephone number and address can be found on the box cover or in the catalogue.